The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We are so lucky to be here today with Scott Berman, who is a buy and hold investor with 18 units between Wisconsin and Kentucky, and he focuses on cash flow. He's had assignments all over the world, including Pakistan, Costa Rica, Kazakhstan, and Washington, D.C. He's been all over. He has properties in the U.S., and we're really happy to have him here. He is also the founder of the Foreign Service Real Estate Investors Facebook group, which I checked today has over 2,000 members. So I'm sure it's grown quite a bit since you started, Scott. So welcome to the show. To start off, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the Facebook group. How did it start?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I've been in real estate since 2013, and I was definitely, you know, like everybody starting out, not an expert, didn't really have any background. But I'm seeing all these people in the Foreign Service who, you know, they've bought real estate. You know, the Foreign Service is full of really smart people. You know, whether they've been investing in their hometown or they became accidental landlords when they bought in DC and they moved overseas. So I figured it'd be a great resource to tap into. Also, you know, it's kind of like a little bit of a closed community where, you know, we've all got these, you know, clearances and corridor reputation is a huge thing in the State Department. So you can kind of like trust the people that you're talking to a little bit. And I figured it'd just be a great place to swap tips and contacts and, you know, ideas on how we could all kind of grow our real estate investment portfolio and generate some wealth. Of course, we just shot, to 2,000 members. I think last week somebody posted something about it in trailing houses and, you know, everybody jumped on it. So it's great to see all the new members and, yeah, people asking questions. And I've learned a ton and it's been really useful.
I get so much information from that Facebook group. How has it actually changed your investing and the kinds of information that you get from there? Have you found partners through it? Have you found deals?
Yeah. So, I mean, actually, you know, I was Tanya, I mean, she just gave me a contact last week. We're kind of in the market for a vacation rental. Like everybody, we've been cooped up for the pandemic. So we've been looking around at what our next move might be. And we've considered a few different places for a vacation rental. And she put me in touch with a real estate agent that hopefully will be fruitful. So yeah, that's just one way there.
I love it. The Facebook group is actually, I mean, it's kind of the same idea that we have for the podcast, right? Which is, you're right. There's a ton of smart people around the world doing really cool things in real estate and in other investments, right? And just beyond the 9 to 5. And wouldn't it be great if we could just have them in one place to, you know, kind of have a fireside chat and kind of pick their brain and see what they're up to? Because there's actually a lot of things that, I mean, even for me, I'm like, wow, I didn't even know people were doing that. And maybe I can do that too, right? So I think it's a really great resource. And that page has been amazing, I think, for me too, because I've connected with so many people who are doing cool stuff in different markets too. And actually, that kind of leads us to your story. Why don't you tell us your investment story in terms of, okay, so you started in 2013, right? And what made you start and how did it go initially? Did you think that you wanted to be an investor when you started, or was it kind of like, you know, in my case, I was like, hey, I got this house and I need a house. So that's, you know, I wasn't planning to be an investor. Did you have that in mind when you started?
Not exactly. So basically I was coming back from Costa Rica. I was on home leave up in Boston where my wife was working. She had just finished law school, so she wasn't in Costa Rica with me. And so this was like the first chunk of time I had to really think. Like, you know, when you're at post, life's busy and you don't really have to like just stop. You don't have time to like stop, decompress and think about what you want to do next. So I was sitting there on home leave and I knew that we were moving to DC next. And I, you know, I hear all the horror stories about how expensive it is or you've got this crazy commute. And that all sounded horrible to me. Like I didn't want anything to do with that. So, you know, we were just brainstorming of different ways that we could like live in DC comfortably and affordably and minimize our commute. And I don't know how I came across it. Maybe it was Bigger Pockets, but like the idea of house hacking, it was just it was just like awesome for me, where we could basically buy a place and we could have somebody rent out a room and it would offset part of the mortgage. And, you know, maybe we'd get a cool roommate out of it. So we were trying to figure out how we were going to do this. One weekend, we drove down to DC just to look at some open houses to kind of get a better feel for the market. And ended up really liking the first realtor at the first the realtor at the first open house that we went to. So we started working with him. We put in some offers. No luck. Even back in 2013, the DC market was crazy. It seems it's always crazy.
Yeah, it was heating up then. It was like getting out of that slump after the bubble 2013. I remember too. It was like people were like, "Oh my gosh, all the stuff was on sale," and there was intense interest.
Sure, sure. And we were under a little bit of pressure because, you know, home leaves only roughly a month. So we made our one trip to DC and then we moved down here on, you know, temporary quarter subsistence. We stayed in an Airbnb for a month and we really wanted to buy a place. So we found this one place on Capitol Hill. It was a 2-unit row house way outside our budget. So it was listed at $775,000. And I'm from Michigan where houses, you know, a lot of my friends live in houses that are like $150,000. They're pretty decent.
Yeah.
So like 775 is just like insane to us, but we dug into it. We looked, so it's 2-unit. We were going to live upstairs and we were going to rent out the basement. We figured we can get a little bit of money for the basement and it would all work out. Our realtor was like, "It's not going to go for 775. You have to add an escalation clause." We were like, "Okay, we really want the house. Let's win. Let's do it." So I don't remember what our escalation clause went up to, but we ended up winning the house for $857,000, which was just
mind-boggling. Yeah,
totally, totally. We didn't have the 20% down for that, and we didn't want to pay PMI, and we didn't know all of our options. So we actually the mortgage broker had to figure out how to finance it for us. We had to get a HELOC against the equity that we were going to have in the house. So we had two mortgages right off the bat. It was relatively crazy what we did, but we really thought through it. We did the numbers. We thought we could make it work. And we did. We ended up renting out the basement to a long-term tenant for the first year and a half, and he was great. And at the same time, we had this extra bedroom in the upstairs unit where we were living, and we had that on Airbnb after a while. This was before we had kids. We like meeting interesting new people. So we put it on Airbnb and we were doing quite well with that. We had people from all over the world, lots of interesting characters, made some friends that we still talk to. And we were basically covering our mortgage between the downstairs tenant and the Airbnb that we're doing upstairs, covering our mortgage. And we actually made enough to pay for our wedding too. So it was pretty lucrative. Then after the downstairs tenant moved out, we ended up putting the downstairs on Airbnb, and then we started really killing it. Where I think our mortgage payment between the two payments was roughly $3,800. There was months where we would make $5,000. There was months where we made like $6,000 a month. So we were doing quite well, essentially living in DC for free. So we kind of like totally gamed the system and worked it out.
I'm curious, was this like a fixer-upper at all? I mean, at that price point, or are you just buying something that's relatively turnkey?
Relatively turnkey. There were a few things that we had to do. The basement unit wasn't tip-top, so we had to put a little bit of money, but like, I don't know, less than $10,000 in there. It was more or less turnkey, yeah.
Sometimes people ask me, they're like, "Oh, well, you know, you bought it 7 years ago and it was so much cheaper then." I mean, do you think somebody could do the same thing right now in the current market?
Yeah. So my wife's sister, she's out in California and she's doing the same thing where they're house hacking. They have a place and they're renting out one of their rooms and I don't think they're covering their full mortgage, but they're doing quite well.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's the great thing about, you know, house hacking. It doesn't have to be two separate units, right? It can be bedrooms. And, you know, lots of cities, DC in particular, there's tons of people that don't want to, you know, splurge and do the one bedroom by themselves because it's actually quite expensive, but they'll be happy to share with other, you know, housemates. So it's not a strategy for everybody. It's definitely a strategy to get in, but you know, the bedroom count is definitely, I think, something to look at.
Sure. And I don't think I would do it. Like, you know, once we have kids, I don't really want, you know, strange people in the house.
Right.
But before we had kids, I mean, it was awesome. You'd come home from work and you'd have, you know, a glass of wine in the backyard with these folks and they'd tell you their stories. We had, like a senior advisor to the prime minister in New Zealand stay with us. We had a Lonely Planet writer stay with us for a week. We had some pilots from Scandinavia stay with us. I mean, it was a really fun time. Yeah.
Do you have any horror stories?
I don't know if it's a horror story, but there was one kid who smoked pot in our house. He opened up the window and he was smoking pot out of it, and we found the roach the next morning. So definitely not something that we wanted, but you know, wasn't the end of the world. Sure. So, I mean, we were like super geeked with real estate after this, because like we figured we'd just, you know, hacked the system, figured out how to live in DC for free. So we thought real estate was, you know, the coolest thing. So we were talking to a lot of our, talking to our friends about what we were doing. And we were trying to find other ways that we could, you know, get into real estate. So my brother-in-law had a friend in California who was, you know, big into real estate. He's got, I think, a master's in chemical engineering, but he never worked in that field. He just loves real estate, and he just was a wealth of information for us. So we started talking to him, and he was buying duplexes and single family homes in Milwaukee. So we met up, we flew out to California, met up with him at a cafe, worked out a partnership agreement, basically, where we were going to buy houses together. So I think he already had, you know, more than a dozen. So he already had the systems in place. He had, you know, his preferred realtor, his property management. He knew which neighborhoods were good and which ones to avoid. So we basically used his knowledge. And then for the first couple of deals, we went 50-50 and we bought these houses together. And then, you know, once we were kind of comfortable working with him, you know, to be fair, we started being the money people, and he had all the brains and the systems in place. So we ended up buying, it was six or seven properties with him in Milwaukee. The way we made it work was we basically gave a loan to our partnership to buy the properties. We had a promissory note all done up and did it, you know, properly. And then we, bought the properties together. So we owned them 50-50, but we were providing some of the money, and we were using our credit because our friend didn't have a W-2, so he couldn't get loans. Yeah, I mean, you're right. It definitely helped that we already kind of had a relationship through my brother-in-law. And it, you know, it was really important for us to fly out there and actually meet him face-to-face and, you know, get to know him a little bit. We really only met before we started doing deals. We only met with him once. And just to get a sense of what he was all about, we looked at his properties. We looked at some of his, what he had already done to, like, you know, establish his bona fides, that he actually knows what he's talking about. He actually had his real estate license out in California as well. So that all played into it. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just like with any sort of relationship, you want to get to know somebody and see if, you know, they're just talking smack or if they really know what they're talking about. And then, you know, we actually didn't go through a lawyer, which we probably should have, but you know, we were kind of starting out and we didn't want to pay the money. So we pulled off a partnership agreement offline, and my wife's actually an attorney in, you know, a different field, but she looked through it and she thought it looked decent enough, and we just, you know, we just went with it. Felt good.
And how long of a time period are we talking about that you bought these six or seven properties in? Is it like a year, 2 years? And, you know, how has that partnership kind of aged over time? Like, have you needed to change it at all? In hindsight, looking back, would you have done anything differently?
So we started buying with him in 2015, and we bought those properties between 2015 and 2018. And, you know, I don't think we would have done anything differently. I mean, there's always more research I could have put into the market. Because really we were fairly reliant on him for his knowledge, and his systems. So we contributed the money and he contributed kind of like the brains. And there is always room for me to dig into it more and to understand and to help him look for properties. But he really did the most with that. As far as the partnership evolving, you know, we still talk on a fairly regular basis. We actually just refinanced four of the So this is another win here. So we refinanced four of the properties, closed on the refinances last week, and we were betting on, you know, just the cash flow on these properties. So they're all relatively, I can give you some examples, the numbers. They're all relatively low-end properties. So I would say they're Class C+ or B- neighborhoods. So not great, but not war zones. The first one we bought was $87,000. And so the mortgage payment on that was $645 a month. We were pulling in $1,300 a month. So nice. Yeah, pretty good money there. And we just refinanced that one, and the appraisal came in at like $160,000 something. So this property almost doubled in 6 years. So we were really surprised with that, actually, because we knew it was going to appreciate a little bit. But for it to appreciate, you know,
doubles amazing. That's incredible. We were
pleasantly surprised. Yeah. And I mean, part of the strategy was to, you know, to buy in the path of progress. And we bought on the edge of a neighborhood that was kind of rough, that was next to a neighborhood that was doing better. And so we were hoping for a little appreciation, but for it to do that was great. And another one was similar. So we actually, I mean, to get into the numbers, we gave a $95,000 loan to our partnership, and we just did a cash out and got $97,000 back and lowered our interest rates on all four of the properties.
Sweet.
So yeah, all in, we now own five houses. We own one of them outright with no loan, and each of us put up roughly $25,000. So for $50,000, we own five properties, and it's I don't know. I think it's great.
Amazing. No, that's terrific. And I love hearing about the appreciation too, because a lot of times I think, you know, when people are considering markets like Milwaukee or even in the Midwest, right? One of the things that they take into account is this going to appreciate? And general people don't see a bunch of appreciation, right? So it's actually interesting to hear that you did see it, right? And I think that buying on the path of progress, or, you know, I think having that expert eye for value in the market is so important. Because I think that's going to do people well, no matter what area they're looking at.
Yep, completely agree. I mean, again, we were surprised because we bought these properties for the same price what they were selling for back in the late 80s. So, because you can see the purchase history, and you know, I guess the market goes up and down there, and we got quite lucky.
So how do you know about Milwaukee? Like, what do you do to learn about this market? Is it just all like Google and Zillow and BiggerPockets, or what do you do?
The internet's amazing. Yeah. So again, I mean, he's the brains behind the Milwaukee operation. We dug into it a little bit, but yeah, I mean, you can do anything from anywhere in the world now. So even with the pandemic, there's nothing stopping you from hopping online. BiggerPockets is great. There's a site called Rent-A-Meter, which you can use to figure out what rents are based on your property in that neighborhood. There's, you know, you can triangulate Zillow, Trulia, and Redfin. And obviously you want to get a good realtor who you trust, who's got like a, you know, an investment mindset, like Tanya was saying, because if you can get a realtor who just kind of like, you know, wants to get you into your dream house, but like, it's a totally different agent that you're looking for when an investor mindset is what you need. So we had that, and, you know, I'm not a risk averse person. I don't take crazy risks, but this didn't feel like a crazy risk to me because, you know, you see the photos, you've got an inspector who, you know, you're paying good money to make sure that the house looks decent. And, you know, once you've done it more than once and you've got kind of a relationship with these people, their reputation's on the line, and they want it to work for you. And it just felt like it wasn't that big of a leap.
So at this point, you've got your Capitol Hill row house, right? And you've got these houses in Milwaukee. What happens next?
So at this point, we had moved overseas. I was out in Almaty, Kazakhstan, and we had our Capitol Hill row house rented out. So the upstairs was rented out to a great Foreign Service family and great tenants. And the downstairs, we were still Airbnb-ing because it was so lucrative. We wanted to stick with it. And one of the big challenges we had was finding a short-term rental property manager on Capitol Hill. We had been looking for months prior to us going overseas, and they all either wanted too much money to make it make sense, or they couldn't do the flips the same day so you get the maximum number of nights, or for whatever reason, we just didn't like them. And then like literally 2 days before we were getting on a plane, somebody responded on the listserv saying they knew somebody who could do it. And we were like, sweet, let's do it. We met that person the next day on a Sunday, worked a deal out. And then she was fantastic. And she's got like a little company. I think she still does it, where she, you know, services short-term rentals on Capitol Hill. So We continued to do really quite well between the upstairs long term and the downstairs short term, until roughly 2018, when it seemed like every other house on Capitol Hill was
an Airbnb.
Doing Airbnb. Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
There was a saturation that, you know, in the market.
It was, yeah, because everybody's got like the downstairs units, so it's easy to make a little income. And we went from, I don't know the exact numbers, roughly like 150 a night for the downstairs unit to like 100 a night, and more vacancies. And frankly, other properties were a little nicer than ours. And we weren't getting the homestead exemption because we weren't living in the house. So financially, it wasn't doing as well as it was. And we were thinking, you know, maybe we could take the money that we've got and sell the house and buy something in a different market where we could, you know, the return would be a little bit better. So we were toying with the idea of selling it. And back then there was this this feature on Zillow called Make Me Move. I don't think they have it anymore. But we were like, all right, let's just, you know, put the house on there. And it's kind of like for sale by owner, but not quite. It's just kind of like, yeah, I don't really want to sell it, but if somebody wants to buy it, I'll consider your offer. So we listed it in 2018 at what we thought was a very aspirational price of $1.15 million, which is, you know, $300,000 more than what we paid for it 5 years before that, and didn't hear anything until we did. And then our upstairs tenants sent us kind of a frantic email saying, hey, are you selling the house? There's a guy who wants to buy your house. Are you kicking us out? Like, we have a lease. And we were like, no. And what happened was some guy saw our ad on Zillow and he left a note on the door saying he wanted to talk to the landlord. And honestly, I didn't pay attention to the first note. I was like, whatever. And then a week later, he came back. He said, no, I really want to buy this house. I want to talk to the landlord. So I was like, okay, I'll talk to him. And traded some emails, hopped on a call. And I guess his mom was getting older and she was in Brooklyn and he wanted to move her down closer to him. And he lived on Capitol Hill. And he offered us 1.13. He said, I can't offer you full price. It's not in my nature, but I'll give you 20 grand less. I'll give you 1.13 million for the house. And this was, you know, I was on the phone. I was in Kazakhstan late at night due to the time difference. And I was just like jaw dropped. I'm like, what?
I can't even imagine. No, apparently not. Like if people ring your doorbell, like, wow.
Yeah. And I mean, I had looked at the comps in the neighborhood and I felt like I was fairly savvy because, you know, I was kind of into real estate and looking around and like, you know, we had a backyard, we had an income unit, we didn't have a garage, but it was a pretty nice place. And, you know, I thought our price was, you know,
crazy.
I thought it was a fair price. Yeah. So like, I was like, oh, sir, well, let me check with my wife. I want to make sure she's on board. And yes, she was. And we worked it out. So we made like 270 grand on that house when we sold it.
This is why I love DC.
Yeah. And I mean, the house is, I'm sure it's worth, you know, 200,000 more than that now because everything's so crazy.
But I was just going to ask if you have gone back to check. I feel like once you sell, you cannot go back. Like, don't look.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I regret selling it. I don't regret selling it because, you know, we took that money and we invested it elsewhere. But we were thrilled. And Tanya, you're not going to like this, but we didn't use an agent at all.
Honestly, more power to you. If you don't need it, you don't need it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely makes sense to use an agent sometimes. Like if you're not super following the market and you don't really know what you're looking at and you just want a little bit of help, I mean, agents are worth their weight in gold. But in our case, you know, I'm DS, so I'm federal law enforcement. The buyer was former Secret Service, so we had this kind of bond. We kind of trusted each other. I got recommendations for and found a DC real estate attorney. And he drew up the contract for $1,000. And, you know, if we would have gone through a realtor, that could have cost us like $60,000 in selling costs. So in this case, it just really kind of worked out. And super, super pleased with how it worked out.
At any point, because, you know, I find working with the Foreign Service community a lot as an agent, people get very nervous about selling their one property in the DC area. There's all this fear about, if I sell now, I won't be able to get back in. And there's this, you know, kind of block, this mental block that people have about selling a property. I mean, to be very honest, I have it too. I have a house in Arlington that I do not live in, and it's been a rental property for 5 years, and I just don't really want to sell it, even though I can roll all the equity into probably a much bigger cash, you know, cash flow property. And I'm curious what advice you would have for those people. You know, did you have any remorse? Did you worry about not being able to afford to go back to DC? I mean, maybe you didn't want to. I'm sort of curious if you might speak to that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, we kind of looked at it analytically in terms of both finances and what we wanted. So the house on Capitol Hill, it had, you know, it was the upstairs unit, which was the nicer unit where we would have lived. It only had 2 bedrooms, and we had 2 kids at this point. And we wanted something bigger, frankly. So when we came back for our next tour in DC, we moved to Silver Spring, where we are now, and we actually rent here. But I mean, obviously, everybody has to make their own calculations based on, you know, if this is their quote unquote forever home, or if financially they're looking at their neighborhood, they think it's going to appreciate quite a bit, and they're kind of betting on the appreciation versus the cash flow, which is, you know, probably better in other markets. But yeah, you gotta look at it holistically and see what makes the most sense for you. So we knew we weren't lifers in DC, so it was an easy call for us. So, you know, we, for a half second, we thought about house hacking again, but we're not going to do that with kids. It's just, there's too many variables that can go wrong there. So we didn't want to do that. And then looking at the numbers, I mean, instead of, you know, if you take out appreciation, because I know appreciation is probably going to happen in DC always. Yeah. I mean, this goes back to the importance of just, you know, growing your network and talking to people and figuring out what other people are doing, which is a lot of what's behind the Foreign Service Real Estate Investors Facebook group. But again, I was out in Almaty, and another DS agent was down from Yekaterinburg. There's an awesome ski resort just outside Almaty, so he was down skiing for a week. And, you know, DS agents, we look after each other. So when somebody's in town, you try to, like, you know, take them out and go out to dinner or whatever. And you guys know him, Joe Burkhead. And so he was down, and this was right after we had closed on the Capitol Hill deal. And, you know, we're having dinner in a yurt, like on the ski slope, and probably having horse meat steak or something because it's Kazakhstan. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, we just sold this, and it was pretty exciting and kind of like real estate. And at that point, I had no idea what Joe was up to. And he's a pretty modest dude. And he was like, oh,
with an amazing story.
An amazing story.
Amazing this guy's story.
A rock star.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Hey. And so, yeah, so I told Joe what I did. And, you know, Joe being Joe, very modest, he's like, oh, I'm also into real estate. I'm like, oh, what do you got? What's your interest? And he's like, well, back in the military, I've been buying since 2001. And I don't want to give his whole story away, but the guy is like,
unbelievable.
So I was super enthusiastic about that. And I was like, Joe, you are the man. And I was like, how can I get in on this? And, you know, how can I, you know, work with you or learn from you? And he's been like a great mentor to me. He showed me what he's been doing, where he is in Kentucky. And I ended up buying 4 duplexes there with his assistance. So, you know, we're not partners. So we bought everything. Me and my wife bought everything ourselves there, but we rely on the systems that he's built. So he's got a great property management team. He had the lender in place. He knows what to look for. And we're basically just following in his footsteps. So, you know, the almost 300 that we made on the Capitol Hill house, we, you know, put some of that in stocks, put some of it into Fundrise, and then bought these 4 duplexes in Kentucky that the same property manager manages. And they're fantastic. Like, they cash flow, I think it's between $450 and $750 a piece each duplex. And then there's been appreciation there too, because the country's, you know, on fire right now. So,
in a good way.
In a good way. Yeah. Good fire.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're always looking for more. So we bought a couple more in Kentucky since then, and there's just not enough. If there was, you know, 10 more, I would go buy those. And I know Joe would too. So that's kind of where we are now. That gets us up to the 18 units that we have. Yeah, always looking.
Question about different markets, right? So you're in Milwaukee and in Kentucky. Now that you've got some hindsight, do you have any thoughts about which market is better and why, or are they just different, you know, in terms of cash flow? Any thoughts on, you know, different neighborhood classes now that you can compare in two different markets? I'm just sort of curious because, you know, one of the questions I think a lot of people have is, where should I invest? And do I want like a low dollar, you know, not high appreciation market? Do I want something else? Do I want like a city versus a secondary versus a tertiary market? Maybe if you could speak to that a little bit, that would be, I think that would be interesting for our listeners.
Sure. I'll caveat that with like, I am in no way like a professional real estate investor. Like this is a hobby for me that's just kind of taken off. So I'm not an expert in all this sort of analysis. And I know there's lots of other super smart people out there that know these things a lot better than me.
But from your experience, right? Because I mean, they are two different markets and they're different types of properties, right? Because you have single family homes, right? In Milwaukee?
Versus... mostly single family and a couple duplexes still, and then all duplexes in Kentucky.
Small multi and single family. I'm just curious, you know, from your perspective, what the differences are.
Sure. So in Milwaukee, it's kind of a rougher city, frankly. So we're buying kind of in the city proper, and then next door in Wauwatosa, which is a little nicer. And those are kind of rougher neighborhoods where you can get houses for, you know, at least when we were buying them, under $100,000, and they will cash flow quite well. So people talk about the 1% rule, where if you buy a house for $100,000, you should be able to get a $1,000 per month in rent. So it's fairly easy to make there in Milwaukee, at least it was. But with that, you kind of get rougher tenants sometimes. So I think one of the biggest mistakes, I don't know, one of the biggest, I don't know if it was a mistake.
Maybe.
Yeah. It was a learning point. Was we bought a house it was a duplex for $40,000 in Milwaukee because it just cash flowed insane. Yeah. I mean, it was, I think all in our mortgage payment, including escrow for, you know, insurance and taxes, was something like $500 a month. And for the two units, we were getting like $1,400 a month.
Nuts.
But yeah, it was nuts. It was just nuts. But it was a huge problem because like the tenants were super problematic and the house kept having repairs and falling apart. So we decided never to buy like a house. We ended up selling that house for, I think, what we bought it for $40,000. It was, you know, I don't think we lost money. I think we probably broke even on it overall, even after the repairs. But we're not investing in super low-end neighborhoods anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of Milwaukee that's still kind of like that. There's also neighborhoods that are doing better. Whereas in Kentucky, it was it's more of the suburbs that we're buying in. You've got like a little, you know, better quality tenants, for lack of a better term, who don't cause the problems. For whatever reason, the cash flow there is still quite good. I think a lot of it is duplexes where, at least in that market, you can do better with duplexes than single family homes. Just the price to rent ratio is better where you can get the more money off the two units. I'm not sure that's always the case, but people there don't, I mean, in my experience, they don't seem to mind living in duplexes. So it kind of works out there.
So one of our goals with this podcast is to talk about different kinds of investing. And you mentioned just now that you invested some of that money in stocks and then some of that money in a site called Fundrise. What is Fundrise? Is it like a syndication platform? And how did it work out for you?
Yeah, basically. So that's also quite well. It's just, you know, the idea is just to diversify more. So as you can probably guess, I kind of like real estate. I'd say we're mostly 50-50 between, you know, stocks and real estate, including the Fundrise. And Fundrise is just it's a internet-based platform where you're buying lots of tiny shares in multiple properties. So it doesn't let you pick a specific property that you like. It basically has funds set up where you can invest in, like, you know, broader markets. You know, I think they have like a Midwest fund, a West Coast, an East Coast fund. And you know, just like with dollar cost averaging into stocks, you can kind of dollar cost average into, you know, different real estate portfolios. And I think I've been with them 3 years and they average, I think, you know, between 8% and 11% per year. And, you know, they charge their fee, obviously. And there's, you know, I definitely recommend people, like, you know, go online and read the reviews. for the most part, positive reviews. Some people think you can do a lot better investing in REITs and REITs. And you can, I think you can do a lot better investing in your own real estate, but it's just another place to store some money to diversify a little bit.
Is there a minimum amount in Fundrise that you need to invest? Or like, how does it work? You just go on and you're like, I want to invest, I don't know, $5,000 or, and then they tell you there's different classes of funds. Like, I mean, I've never been on there to be very honest. So, you know, I'm just sort of curious for the newbies out there, if they are interested in this kind of thing, how does it work?
So I think the minimum is, I think it's $1,000 or maybe $500. So it's not much. And you just sign up for an account and you deposit the $1,000 and they are constantly opening up new funds. So they divide your money. You can tell them you want to be focused on dividends. So less on, growth and more on dividends if you're, a retiree, for example. Or if you, if you're younger and you've got a long time horizon, you can invest more for appreciation. You'll make more in the long run. And then they kind of, they got their fancy algorithm and they put your money in there. And just like in real estate, it's not liquid. So whatever money you put in there, you should expect to have in there. They actually charge you a penalty if you try to take it out before whatever it is, 3 or 5 years. So it's kind of set and forget. You're outsourcing the work that's required if you were actually, buying real estate yourself. But, it's, again, just another way to diversify. I think you hit on it exactly. So education and saving for a down payment. So, one of the reasons I wanted to come on your podcast was to like talk to foreign service people, because I feel like I'm an example of somebody who's kind of figured it out. I kind of lucked into it. Like most people, I started with no real knowledge of this, but like the Foreign Service offers so many advantages for folks that want to get, on the real estate ladder. We have rock solid jobs where, you have a job for life if you want it. We get paid pretty decently. You live in overseas, so you can save up some money because you don't have to make that house payment. You're living for free. The Foreign Service has this reputation of, male pale in Yale, where everybody comes in with money. And people, when I talk about real estate, people think I came in with money. I definitely did not. And I just want to say, like, if you're in the Foreign Service, you are kind of set up to do this if you want to. Mm-hmm. You're surrounded by smart people. You've got, tools and resources like this podcast and the Facebook group and all the free stuff that's out there. And, Zillow, Redfin make it so easy to research stuff. And just talk to your network and see who's already doing this, because I guarantee at every post there's somebody who's kind of maybe not to the level of Joe, but they know what they're doing. And see where you can make it work. Maybe it's your hometown, because everybody's got a hometown. We're all from the US. And maybe it's not. Maybe your hometown doesn't work, but there's lots of avenues to explore, and just stay curious, and it will work. Real estate, like everybody talks about, it's forgiving in the long run, because not every neighborhood, but eventually most neighborhoods, they do appreciate. And even if you're definitely going to make some mistakes along the way, but they all kind of even out in the long run, as long as you've done a little bit of research and you have a sanity check and you make some not perfect, but decent decisions.
And that, my friends, you heard here from Scott Berman. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. I really love your story. I think one of the things I really like about it, because, all investors are different. And I feel like the way that you did it was maybe the way I should have done things, because I like how, you don't overthink stuff. It seems to me that when you meet with people, you're like, I trust that guy. It makes sense. It's logical. I'm just going to do it. And there's not like this whole hand wringing, like, oh my goodness, I'm really, you make the decision and you move forward, right? You don't get stuck in that, analysis paralysis. And also I really like the pattern I found in your story of like this sort of like drafting off of other people, right? Like you don't need to go in there and be some cowboy and reinvent the wheel. It's like, you're already working with people who know the market really well. And you're kind of drafting off of the effort that they've already put in to your advantage. And so you can still be overseas and do all this stuff. And so, I mean, I love your story. I think it's great. I think, it's going to inspire a lot of people that, maybe don't want to do it as actively, or maybe not as passively as something at Fundrise, but there's like a good blend, right? And I think you're a really great example of that.
I think that's the perfect way to say it, is to draft off other people, because I do not think I would be really comfortable just going into a new market by myself and relying on just myself to do the analysis. Like, having mentors in place and seeing like trailblazers do it before you, and then kind of working with them and learning from them constantly, it gives you such an advantage, and you get like that extra boost of confidence that what you're doing is not crazy and that it is doable. And I think you're definitely right that drafting is a great way to build up your portfolio. This was great. Thank you very much.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.